The key regional thing that's different is the support of pretty much the entire Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC, plus Egypt and Jordan, plus Indonesia, Pakistan. All of these Muslim-majority countries are on board with this plan. Historically, the Arab League would have their plan, Israel would have a plan, and never the twain shall meet. Well, now the twain has met in this plan. Yes, there are a lot of issues, a lot of question marks, but I think those two issues both make it more urgent and maybe increase its possibility for success.
Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what is happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Lahab Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute Senior Fellow and Senior Political Correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, Executive Director of the Misgav Institute and a Visiting Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The Misgav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center focused on strengthening Israel's security, its regional integration, and its international alliances. Each week, we bring you fresh insights, not only into the most critical developments in Israel and the Middle East, but also key updates on the most important trends and opportunities in this incredible region.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to your podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
And we read and respond to all of your comments, so please keep them coming. Today, we have a fascinating guest, very timely, Dr. Victoria Coates, former Deputy National Security Advisor under the first Trump administration and currently Vice President of the Heritage Foundation. Yes, where I'm also a visiting fellow. But before we get to Victoria, we've had a really incredible week of ups and downs, of roller coasters, of statements by Hamas and statements by President Trump and statements by Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday. And everybody's sort of being on edge as to where is this deal going? Are we going to see an end to the war? Are we going to see a release of the hostages? So, Lav, where do you think we are and how do you see Hamas's response? And where do you think we're going from here?
So when we're recording this, and because of the holiday of Sukkot, it'll probably come out in a few days. So it's possible that we'll miss something in our discussion. But where we stand right now, it's Sunday night. On early Saturday morning, Hamas responded to the Trump plan. They didn't really say yes. They actually said things that contradict the plan. But they did agree to release the hostages in exchange for Palestinian terrorists in prison. Which is the start of the plan. And so based on that, President Trump decided this means that Hamas wants peace, Israel must stop the bombing in Gaza, and Israel agreed to it. And on Monday morning, which will be in the past by the time you listen to this, Israel sent a team to Cairo to negotiate. And I would say Prime Minister Netanyahu gave a statement on Saturday night that was cautiously optimistic. He said, in a few days, we may be able to say that we've achieved bringing home all the hostages. Here's hoping. But Hamas's response is something that's interesting because the Trump administration really presented it as, oh, they accepted our plan and now we just need to work out the details, when that's not quite what they said.
Exactly. Hamas's response was very carefully worded. And there's a key phrase that some people didn't notice, where they said that they've agreed in principle to release what they call the occupation prisoners, meaning the hostages which they kidnapped. But then they explain, according to the exchange formula contained in President Trump's proposal, with the necessary field conditions for implementing the exchange. And I think that what we're going to see over the next 24 hours is they're using that phrase to try to draw out the negotiations, they're going to say that, well, the field conditions don't allow, and until Israel pulls back further from the Gaza Strip, then we can't go and find out where all the hostages are. And we have to, in the field, we don't hold all the hostages. Islam Jihad or other terrorist groups hold some of the hostages. And some of them were, I think I've already said, some of them are buried because Israel killed them. I think that that's an opening for them to say, we agree to President Trump's plan and we want to release all the hostages, but we can't, and we can't because Israel. And until Israel pulls back, until Israel gives us more time, until Israel, lets us retake more parts of the strip. We're not going to be able to do that. And I think the key question we're going to see over the next 24 hours is whether Israel and particularly the United States allows Hamas to draw out and try to take that sort of very clear demand of within 72 hours of accepting the agreement, release all the hostages, and turn that to something that's much more prolonged, which is what really Hamas would like.
So I think it's clear when you look at the different public statements that are coming out that Israel has expressed a concern of that kind to President Trump. And I say that because I believe it was on Saturday night, or maybe it was early Sunday morning here in Israel, President Trump posted on Truth Social a map of where Israel is supposed to withdraw at the start of the ceasefire, right? And it essentially is to withdraw to where Israel was this summer. So to not be in Gaza City anymore. It might be a little bit further back, but more or less, right? And that's a real achievement for Israel. In pressuring Hamas, or you could say it's an achievement for the U.S. or even Qatar, but they've pressured Hamas enough that Hamas has dropped its previous demand that Israel fully withdraw from Gaza before all hostages are released. So I think the fact that President Trump posted that map is an indication that they see that map as more or less what is going to have to happen, that, you know, Israel is not going to fully withdraw. I mean, Israel doesn't need to fully withdraw from Gaza, according to Trump and at all. Israel would maintain the perimeter, is what Israelis have been calling it, which is a buffer zone all around Gaza, including the Philadelphia corridor. That's part of the Trump plan. I don't see Israel giving up on that. You never know. But I mean, I hope not. I don't really see how Israel could continue to protect its security from a possible sort of resurgent terrorist threat if it doesn't do that.
And I think that's it's a 20-point plan. There's lots of details. There's lots of international stabilization force and the Board of Peace and the technocratic government. In some senses, what I think we really put your finger on now is what's really important from Israel's perspective. The way I see it, Israel has agreed to, first of all, I think it certainly is an achievement by Israel, by Prime Minister Netanyahu and Minister Ron Dermer and everybody who was involved in the negotiations to get to an agreement where, at least according to what's envisioned, all the hostages are released and Israel does not leave the Gaza Strip entirely but stays in that perimeter. I think those are basically the two really important elements. This is my reading. This is not something that I've heard from the inside, but those are really the two most important elements, meaning we get the hostages back, we stay in this perimeter, we stop the war. Everything else, whether or not Hamas is disarmed or not disarmed, whether Gaza is de-radicalized, not de-radicalized, whether the stabilization force takes security, doesn't take security, whether the Gaza transition authority is set up, isn't set up, it would be great if all those things happened. But essentially Israel's saying, we're stopping the war. We're likely leaving Hamas in power, at least de facto on the ground. Right? We don't really envision international force forcibly, right? The plan envisions Hamas can decommission its weapons or they can leave. What if they don't want to decommission their weapons and they don't want to leave? Who's going to forcibly take away their weapons? Unlikely.
Well, Netanyahu is saying, I mean, and again, we'll see what actually happens, but Netanyahu keeps saying we can do it the easy way or the hard way, meaning like if Hamas doesn't want to lay down its weapons, then Israel will force them to. And Trump did say to Netanyahu, you know, you'll do what you have to do. If Hamas doesn't agree to it. So again, we have to wait and see if it happens, but at least on the level of what Israel is saying it wants and what the Trump administration is saying it wants is for Israel to do the act of demilitarizing and then the transitional government and the quote unquote peace board to do the maintenance.
And the importance of all these international institutions, there's some who've been saying that Hamas was ready for this deal in the past. Now, I think it's actually true. Hamas would have been willing to release some or most or all the prisoners for a guarantee that the war was ending. And the challenge was that there was never any kind of guarantee, even at least in the past, right? A promise by President Trump or some people said a UN Security Council resolution. I don't think there was any actual guarantee that would have convinced Hamas that once it gives back all of the hostages, the war will really end. I think that the Trump plan, the 20-point plan, is an attempt to do that. It's an attempt to say, you know, the war really is going to an end and Hamas, you can have amnesty, you can leave, you can go somewhere else. And the question really is Hamas going to buy into that? And are they going to say, okay, this really, from our perspective, guarantees our continued survival. And therefore, we're willing to release the hostages because of the pressure from the Qataris and from Turkey and from other countries. Those countries' desire to show the United States that they're on board with this vision. So that really needs to be seen.
So I do want to push back a little because I really disagree with the argument that we could have had this deal a year ago or that we could have had this deal, in February when we didn't continue to phase two of the ceasefire deal? And a big part of it is because Hamas, up until now, never agreed to release all of the hostages unless Israel fully withdrew from Gaza. And that's a big thing, right? Israel has maintained that it needs this perimeter, this buffer zone around Gaza for its security. But I also just think that the pressure on Hamas from Israel entering like the final strongholds of Hamas in Gaza did something, you know, that was convincing. I also think that the Israeli strike in Doha really rattled the Qataris, who then went to the Trump administration and sort of said, okay, now is the time. And there are reports that show that back in January, February, Qatar told Hamas to hold on to the hostages and not give them up. And now Qatar's doing the opposite. So I don't think that this is a deal that could have been achieved before. Maybe it could have been achieved a couple months ago before Israel actually went into Gaza City if Hamas really believed Israel would. But I do think the Qatari element is important here.
And I think people need to understand also that what Israel was doing in Gaza City is different than what it had done in the past. It's true that there had been troop movements and strikes in Gaza City, but what we saw over the past week was Israel really for the first time fully encircling Gaza City, essentially taking over the main exit from Gaza City. According to Israeli estimates, 800,000, 900,000 Gazans had left Gaza City. There was most of the people left were Hamas or affiliated with Hamas, but the Hamas people could also leave. But now they would have to go through an Israeli inspection point. And I think you're right. That did, should Israel have done that a year ago, a year and a half ago? Maybe. But now Israel was doing it for the first time. And that did get Hamas much more nervous that its main stronghold would fall. We also saw this week, there's a lot of talk about breaking aid into the Gaza Strip as part of the deal, but there were other people who tried to bring in aid. There was this 41-ship flotilla led by Greta that met an Israeli welcoming committee when they reached, I think it was 150 nautical miles from Israel. And what did we see, and how did Israel handle the event?
So there were, I believe it was 430-something pro-Palestinian activists who were really in the mood to go yachting. And so they went on a collection of vessels towards Israel, claiming that they were trying to bring humanitarian aid into Gaza. And of course, multiple countries, I think Spain, Italy, maybe not Spain, I think Italy, Greece, the Vatican, all offered to bring the aid in, so that these people wouldn't endanger themselves by trying to break the military blockade. And they kept saying, no, no, no. And of course, when the Israeli Navy stopped the ships, then we found out why, because they basically had no aid. They had like a box of expired baby formula, really useful. There's not a lack of baby formula in Gaza. Like people are, aid agencies are bringing that in. It's just entirely a stunt meant for attention. And you see it now where you have people coming out. So Turkey paid for a plane where all the Turkish activists in the flotilla and then other ones who were more from Eastern countries, not so much European countries, got on the plane. The Turkey flew them all back. And one of the activists said, oh, they were torturing little Greta Thunberg. And I'm like, little Greta Thunberg, she's a grown woman, she's an adult. Just because she dresses like a child and has the haircut of a child, she's a grown woman who made a choice to break the law, and now she's sitting in jail. She also made another choice not to leave, right? There's been flights, and she could have been deported immediately, but she wanted to have her day in court, which I found even more bizarre, because when she appeared in court, which is today, Sunday, all she did was say her name, say that her passport is not expired, she wants to leave Israel, and she wants her fellow prisoners to be able to get medication. Okay. But apparently she complained to the Swedish ambassador that her bed is not comfortable enough and that there are bed bugs, to which most Israelis said, that sounds like being in the IDF. So But there's, it's like darkly humorous, you know, because it's like, it would have been really bad for Israel's PR had President Trump not presented his peace plan in the nick of time. And then Hamas gave its response and then nobody's paying attention or hardly anyone's paying attention to little Greta anymore. But there was one thing that I think Israel's foreign ministry handled it really well, just as they had in the first flotilla, and also the IDF handled it well, not violently. You know, and the foreign minister was putting out all these pictures and showing how they weren't really bringing any aid, and how they declined again and again to transfer aid into Gaza. But then Itamar Ben-Gvir, our national security minister, decided to come in and, you know, strut around the prison and say, "You are all terrorists. You are all terrorist supporters. We're putting you in the same uniforms the terrorist supporters wear, and we're treating you the way terrorist supporters." That may be true, and they might deserve it, but it just served no purpose. And it was like really bad and ran contrary to the PR operation of the other arms of the Israeli government. And I felt like this really exemplifies the total mess that Israel's public messaging can be, in a way that I'm not entirely sure there's a lot to be done about it because of the coalition government system and everybody's sort of jostling and wants their own attention. But it would be nice if our cabinet ministers were more responsible and more willing to coordinate on the sensitive international topics.
And on that note, there is definitely some people who in Israel who are thinking that we may be heading to elections soon, that the Prime Minister Netanyahu's goal may be to get the hostages back. Maybe that leads to an opening for an agreement with Saudi Arabia, for other kinds of expansion of regional cooperation. And then he'll be in a position to say, "Look, you know, yes, maybe I'm responsible. I'm responsible for October 7th, but I'm also responsible for the outcome of the war and of all the achievements of bringing the hostages home." And now it's time to go to elections and for Israelis to pick who they want to lead. And I do think we'll see a lot of, already we're seeing new parties and new forces and people who were in the parliament coming back, people like Yoaz Hendel, other people who are waiting to throw their hat into the ring. So it'll be very interesting to see if we do go to elections in March, April, June, in the coming year, what kinds of new forces, maybe from the younger generation, from people who served hundreds of days on the front lines, and how that refreshes our political arena here in Israel.
I mean, 2026 is definitely an election year. Officially, it doesn't have to be till November. There was some talk that Netanyahu would not want to do it after the anniversary of October 7th, so that it would be, you know, like September the latest. But I'm starting to feel like the vibe that I'm getting from politicians is that it's going to be a lot earlier than that. I mean, maybe not a lot earlier, but like middle of next year. That's like, I just don't think that they're going to hang on that long. And Netanyahu already doesn't have a majority, right? And he's been able to hang on now for a few months like that because the Knesset's been in recess, but it is going to come back in 12 days, I think. And so, you know, we're going to see a mess in the Knesset. And so I would be surprised if this Knesset lasts much longer than, you know, the beginning of next year, January, February, before an election is called.
This week, we interview Dr. Victoria Coates. Dr. Coates is the Heritage Foundation's vice president, where she heads the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy, dealing with a broad range of issues from China to the Middle East to U.S. defense and military strength and buildup. Dr. Coates served as deputy national security advisor during the first Trump administration, focusing on the Middle East and North Africa, overseeing the maximum pressure campaign on Iran, the Peace to Prosperity Middle East Peace Plan, and the initial negotiations for what led to the Abraham Accords. Her long resume in the national security sphere includes serving as senior national security advisor to U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, to then Governor Rick Perry, as an advisor to the U.S. Department of Energy, and many other critical roles to U.S. national security. So stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Dr. Victoria Coates. Dr. Victoria Coates, it's such a pleasure to have you on Mideast Horizons, especially now these days when so much is happening between the U.S., Israel, the Middle East, events and processes that could reshape the Middle East, that could lead to the end of the war, that could lead to the continuation of the war. We all saw the press conference with President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu, and I've always following the day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute news about what's happening. Is Hamas agreeing, not agreeing? What do things look like from Washington? When you served as Deputy National Security Advisor under President Trump, when you look at America's interests, President Trump's interests and priorities, how does this proposed deal look like from the American side?
Well, Asher, it'll have very good to be with you. You know, I think there are a couple of things that are different here. First and foremost, you know, a version of this deal has more or less been on the table for the last 50 years. But what's different here, you know, the most pressing issue is the hostages. You know, it's been 2 years, we'll mark now. And this is just unconscionable that Hamas is still holding them. And then Hamas has not been forced to let them go by the international community, which instead seems intent on forcing Israel to be restrained rather than forcing Hamas to let them go. But that is, you know, step number one in the president's plan. So that's a little bit different. But the key regional thing that's different is the support of pretty much the entire Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC, plus Egypt and Jordan, plus Indonesia, Pakistan. All of these Muslim majority countries are on board with this plan. Historically, the Arab League would have their plan, Israel would have a plan, and never the twain shall meet. Well, now the twain has met in this plan. And so, yes, there are a lot of issues, a lot of question marks still with the plan. But I think those two issues both make it more urgent and maybe increase its possibility for success.
You know, you say that this plan has been on the table for 50 years, but it seems that there was sort of like a unique confluence of events that have made it possible now. And you see different interpretations of this, right? Prime Minister Netanyahu says that we've reached this point because of the pressure that Israel put on Hamas by the IDF entering Gaza City. And then you see reports that say the Trump administration was unhappy with Israel attempting to assassinate Hamas leaders in Qatar, and they decided they've had enough and they want to end the war. I'm sure there are, you know, a dozen other answers someone can give. So what do you think brought us to this moment?
I might embrace the and there, Lahav. I think, yeah, there are a bunch of things that have sort of come together on this timeline to make, you know, this sense, as I said, of urgency to end the war greater. And I do think, you know, there was a lot of very bad activity at the United Nations General Assembly last month that I think did ramp up the pressure on Israel. I think it is just a disgrace that we saw countries like Canada and Australia and Great Britain and France recognize some sort of Palestinian entity when there is no such thing. They have no binding means to make it so. And, you know, that didn't feed one person in Gaza and it didn't release one hostage, that kind of posturing. But it does ramp up the pressure on Israel. I think also, you know, 2 years is an awfully long time for a small country to be at war. So I do think from Israel's perspective, from my view on that, you know, getting this to a satisfactory conclusion on a reasonable time frame is desirable. So I think, you know, the strike on Doha, everybody has an opinion on that. I think it is important that the prime minister spoke to the emir from the Oval Office, you know, and it was out in the public, you know, two heads of state speaking to each other. And I know technically the prime minister is not the head of state, but the head of government, rather, speaking to each other and, you know, in a formal setting. That was an important call. And I think it did a lot to calm those tensions. And then also hopefully to send a message to Qatar that they're not just here as an interlocutor with Hamas, but it's time for them to start putting a lot of pressure on Hamas. So we'll see. But I think all of these things came together, along with the president's very strong interest in getting to this deal, which he's had since 2017.
Well, why do you think it's so important for President Trump to get to this deal? I mean, he's spoken about how he's met the hostage families, expressed very strong sympathy and support for the hostage families, but looking at it from the American national security perspective, Do you think this deal is part of a wider process or a wider vision the president has? How would he like to see the Middle East by the end of his term?
I think his views on it have changed over time. In 2017 timeframe, he just wanted to get to the Israel-Palestinian deal. That, you know, the deal of the century, it was going to be a legacy-building thing for him. But I think after the Abraham Accords, Asher, he had a broader view of what was possible in the Middle East. Because in the first couple of years of the first term, we were laboring under the same misconception that John Kerry was when he said there simply couldn't be any more normalization deals until the Palestinian issue was settled. Well, shockingly, it turns out John Kerry was wrong, that that was not the case, and that we could get to the Abraham Accords with Morocco and Bahrain and UAE and make progress with Sudan and Kosovo. So, I mean, these are all, this was a new reality that the president had there. And I know his vision at that point was to expand the accords, and that that's what he was hoping to do if he were reelected in 2024. Of course, we then had the intervening event of October 7th, 2023. It obviously did not happen on his watch, and I very much believe it would not have, but it did happen. And so he had to deal with the fallout of that. The, you know, it was not as smooth of a path to normalization as we might have originally hoped. But that path remains open. And so I think he sees getting to this deal with the support of those countries that I mentioned, all of those Muslim majority countries, as a way to do enough on the Palestinian issue that it will open up those additional normalizations, particularly with Saudi Arabia.
I want to go back to Qatar. One of the things that happened this week after the Netanyahu-Trump press conference and the announcement of the plan is that President Trump announced that there would be a U.S.-Qatar defense pact. This seemed to be, again, a result of Israel's strike in Qatar on Hamas leaders, that Qatar was looking for guarantees that no one would attack them again. How do you think this fits in with America's defense interests, you know, national security interests? I mean, the agreement seems even close to a NATO-style agreement where if somebody attacks Qatar, America would have to stop them. Do you think that's something that's in the American interest?
And if you could just explain also, since it was an executive order and not a treaty, Is it as enforceable? Is it as what does it mean that it's an executive order and not a treaty that was passed in the Senate?
Well, I don't see this as all that big of a deal. Qatar was already a major non-NATO ally. That's a formal status that they have held, and so that was already in place. They already house Al Udeid, our largest base in the Middle East. So the security partnership, it was, for all practical means, already in place. I think from a Qatari perspective, this has been a difficult year. They first got shelled by the Iranians, in response to our action, and then they got shelled by the Israelis. So I think what they're saying is, you know, this is bad for business, and that's essentially what motivates them is business. And we would like this to end, and we would like the United States to make it clear to people that they should stop doing this. I admit I understand that logic from their perspective. So I don't see this as all that big of a deal. In terms of the structure of it, yes, an executive order while the president is in office is, you know, essentially, you know, his policy that can be reversed by a subsequent executive who can revoke that executive order. And the way, as you said, to make it binding would be to pass it through Congress as a treaty. And I don't know whether they'll try to do that or not. I don't know what kind of appetite there would be. You'd have to get to 60 votes, I believe, in the Senate to pass it as a treaty. So that could be uphill sledding at this point. But that's how you would make it binding if you wish to.
Do you think that Qatar, it's kind of funny, you know, Qatar doesn't have relations with Israel, but the Israelis are spending, you know, a huge amount of time in Qatar, and now the Prime Minister spoke with the Prime Minister of Israel spoke with the Prime Minister of Qatar. And clearly, obviously, despite the efforts of some, you know, some pro-Israel groups, some others who have tried to portray Qatar as a negative actor, and I do think that Qatar has been a negative actor in terms of supporting Hamas and spreading incitement in Al Jazeera, but clearly, that's been ineffective in the sense that Qatar still enjoys very strong support from the administration. Do you think it's possible that Qatar could sort of change paths and join the Abraham Accords? Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, I do. And I misspoke earlier. I said it was the emir that the prime minister had spoken to. You're right. It was the prime minister. But I think, you know, Israel has had an office in Doha that was opened officially, I think, around 2021 timeframe is my recollection. So that has existed. Obviously, there are lots.
I don't remember the years, but I do think I remember this. The base of Israel's open diplomatic activity was actually in Doha, if I recall correctly.
So that I think that is possible. You know, it depends on, you know, what that might look like. It might not be an Abraham Accord type agreement, and I think it's important that Israel have different normalization agreements with different countries. Not everyone is going to fit into the same box, as it were. There could be different priorities. There can be different roles the United States can play in supporting them. So that all, I think, should be much more bespoke than plug and play for any future agreement.
So I know the Heritage Foundation has been doing a lot of work on the future of U.S.-Israel relations, a project sort of examining what those relations should look like in 2048 and Israel's 100th year. Could you tell me a little bit about what Heritage is proposing and maybe specifically talk about the difference between, I guess, the situation now with military aid and what you think would be good for the relationship in the future?
Yeah, this is something that my deputy, both on the NSC and at Heritage, Rob Greenway, who I know is well known to both of you and probably to many in your audience, we've been working on this for almost 10 years now, and very closely with Israeli counterparts to think about the next phase of this relationship. Because, you know, about 15 years ago, with historical context or hindsight rather, you can see a real shift in the relationship to a more equal footing, I think, between Israel and the United States. A lot of that has to do with our intelligence sharing agreements and the maturation of those, that what it means to both of our countries to have that kind of cooperation. And so as Israel has become increasingly powerful and, you know, now it easily in the top 20, if not the top 15 of the most powerful countries in the world, you know, it seems like it's time to think about this relationship, not as one of dependency of Israel on the United States, but getting to that equal footing. And when the United States is such a large donor of military assistance, it's hard to get to that footing. So we thought, you know, how do we change that? And so what we developed, and you can find this plan, it is not in any way secret or nefarious, it's on heritage.org for all to see. But what we thought was, if we worked on the economic and technological cooperation between the United States and Israel, that would be a natural way for Israel's economy to grow. And as the economy grew, if it met certain benchmarks over these next 20-some years to get us to 2048, as it met those benchmarks for growth, you could start shifting the U.S. military assistance from foreign military financing, in which case we pay for it, to foreign military sales, in which case Israel pays for it. And as you do that, if you do it gradually, you know, again, meeting those benchmarks, you can get to 2048 and Israel would no longer require that assistance. And part of the proposal, though, is to put the money the U.S. had been investing in Israel's defense into joint programs. So that money wouldn't go away. It would still be invested, but in things that, you know, work for both of us. And so that is part of it. I think we also are taking steps toward recommending that Israel further develop its own defense industrial base. I think in the last MOU in particular, there was very much a dictate to buy American. You can understand that. That makes sense from a U.S. perspective. We want to grow our base. But the problem is we can't make enough to satisfy European customers, Asian customers, Middle Eastern customers. And so unless we can somehow massively expand our defense industrial base, and I don't see that happening tomorrow, we need partners and allies to start developing theirs. And so, you know, that would be a very different perspective than was taken when the last MOU was negotiated during the Obama administration. So there's a ton in that report. We were also now working on sub-reports, one on technology. There's others on the military side, the defense side, or I guess war side now. We don't talk about the Department of Defense anymore. We talk about the Department of War. But that we're going to build out from that main report more detailed sub-reports.
So I see sitting right behind you is your latest book, The Battle for the Jewish State, How Israel and America Can Win. And I highly recommend to everybody to go out and buy it. How can Israel and America win? And especially given we've seen so many challenges over the last couple of years, from the challenge of terror to the challenge of the international arena and the UN, governments that would rather placate, extremists rather than, or reward Hamas in order for domestic purposes. We've seen the whole media battle and the delegitimization of Israel in America as well. We've seen the woke and all kinds of negative phenomena that now in some ways are being rolled back. So what would winning look like? And also I'd be interested to know a little bit about where your support for Israel, your support for the Israel-American relationship, where did that come from? Was that only a professional, analysis and decision? Was it something that came from other sources?
Oh, well, thank you for mentioning the book. And the audiobook just dropped recently. I recorded it myself, so that was sort of exciting. It was a new experience for me. But the whole key to the point of the book is that the war that technically started on October 7th, 2023, actually started long before then. And it started not only in the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinians and the Iranians, but it started here in the United States. And it primarily, but not exclusively, on our college campuses as anti-Israel, anti-Semitic sentiments took hold and then were being taught to our young people. And the line here, and I learned all about this, it's called settler colonialism, is that Israel is uniquely imperial, racist, and illegal. Those are the three terms they use. And not surprisingly, the other country, though, I guess unique is the wrong word, unique between the two of us, who holds these three characteristics is the United States. So you as a student have been taught all your life that being racist, imperial, and illegal are three terrible things that you don't want to be. And then you're given elaborate peer-reviewed articles about how, under international law, Israel and the United States are these three terrible things. And then you start to believe your professors and that this is a terrible injustice that has happened. And you become radicalized. And that's what has happened. And so I think we needed to identify that problem and see October 7th as a symptom of it, and then the response to October 7th as a symptom of it, as suddenly the outpouring of outrage and concern wasn't for Israel. It was for Hamas. And so that is what the book is about, identifying that, laying out the case for the U.S.-Israel relationship, examining the history of alternatives between the Palestinians and the Iranians, which have not been successful, and then looking at what could happen next. And gratifyingly, a lot of what is being done under the Trump administration is perhaps not surprisingly what I've recommended in the book. It's energy cooperation, economic cooperation, security cooperation, and then broadening Israel's role in the Middle East. And just finally, I said this to the New York Times this spring and they thought it was really shocking. I'm a Christian. I have my reasons for loving the Holy Land, but that's totally secondary to why I support this relationship as a policymaker. It is enormously in the best interests of the United States. And I go into some detail in the book about exactly what this partnership has brought the United States, why President Reagan really thought it was a very good idea in the 1980s to sign the first MOU, our first free trade agreement with Israel. So that's all that can be found in the book, and hopefully your audience would find it of interest.
So on a related topic, I know you started Project Esther, which is the Heritage Foundation's project to counter anti-Semitism in the U.S. Wikipedia, by the way, because I was Googling it to make sure I had the correct description. Do you know what Wikipedia calls it? They say it's a project that aims to suppress pro-Palestinian protests. Wikipedia has really become trash in the last few years. But in any case, could you tell us a little bit about what Project Esther is doing, what its policy recommendations are. I find it, as someone who's for small government, as I think a lot of people at Heritage are, I often find it a challenge where on the one hand, I think the government should combat anti-Semitism. And on the other hand, I'm like, well, what does that really mean without them getting involved in, you know, our basic rights, free speech and things like that? So I'd be interested to hear sort of where you stand on the tension between those things.
Oh, absolutely. And interestingly, I was, not to puff myself up, but I was put on Washingtonian Magazine's list of the most powerful women in Washington. And they literally used that description from the wiki for Project Esther as what I do. And I retweeted it with, that's in my proudest moment. If you think I'm here to quash pro-Palestinian sentiment on campus, you're correct. So Project Esther is importantly a private sector initiative. It is not a government initiative by any stretch of the imagination. And it is Heritage's plan of how you can use legal, legislative, sort of public education venues to combat anti-Semitism. And our view is that free speech is absolutely free, and we are 100% with you, Lav, on that point, but that incitement to violence and material support to terrorism are crimes in the United States and should be treated as such. And so when you are funding a group that is recommending violently anti-Israel and anti-American sentiments, we think you fall into that category. And if we can take steps to penalize you for that behavior or freeze your funding, that's what we'd like to do. And it has its origins in some of the anti-fascist efforts in the United States around World War II. And so we think that's a pretty good model. And the key to all of this is that anti-Semitism is rarely isolated. It is a symptom of something else. And I would point to the recent case in Australia, where the Australians had to expel an ambassador for the first time since World War II. It was the Iranian ambassador, and they expelled him because they discovered that the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran's military, was active in Australia setting up anti-Semitic attacks. They attacked a kosher restaurant, they attacked a synagogue, and they supported the so-called March for Humanity with tens of thousands of people marching across the Sydney Bridge demanding Palestinian statehood. Why is Iran in Australia fomenting anti-Semitic behavior? They're there because they just, and in Australia, one of the most pro-Palestinian of the Western countries. And they're doing it because they don't care. This isn't about the Palestinians. This is about creating unrest in countries allied to the United States, liberal democracies. They hate them. They want to destroy them. But that's anti-Semitism being systemized and weaponized by the Iranians. And that's why it matters. That's why I think we have to get after it. I would like to do it more broadly, but we need to start here at home in the United States.
Talking about Iran, there's a discourse now in Israel, I think legislators in the United States as well, about the possibility of another round of fighting with Iran. And there's different interpretations. There are troop movements and plane movements and evacuations of embassies. What do you think is the likelihood in the short term of another round of military conflict with Iran, either from the Israeli perspective or with U.S. involvement?
I think that's very much up to the Iranians, Asher. I think that both Israel and the United States are not eager for that kind of additional burden on both of us right now. I think we'd like to have tensions calm. I also think we'd like to get a full accounting of exactly where Iran's nuclear program stands. Because if we see them taking steps to reconstitute that program, or that the destruction that we've all hoped for was not as thorough as has been reported, you know, then we're going to have some decisions to make. My understanding is none of those decisions have yet been made. So I would say that's very much a wait and see.
We're, I guess, a week and a half out from when snapback sanctions officially were applied again to Iran. And I know you were in the Trump National Security Council at the time when Trump was for maximum pressure on Iran. How do you think that that's going to impact things moving forward?
No, that's going to be very interesting to see what happens with the snack map, and particularly from the EU, and what it does to Iran's economy. Because, you know, this is all, you know, by choice of the Iranian regime. Iran does not have to be in these straitened circumstances. And as you look at what's happened to them in terms of inflation, unemployment, environmental disaster, energy shortages, go down the list of mismanagement of that beautiful country. And so the question is if what happens with snapback has an additional tightening effect that causes internal disruption and unrest in Iran that might force the Iranian regime to take some different policies, or potentially the Iranian people to take matters into their own hands. Now, you know, President Trump has been very clear that regime change is not the United States' errand in Iran. The nuclear program is what commands our official attention. But he's also said that if the government of Iran is not serving the people of Iran, then, you know, they should have the right to make a change, which they haven't had since 1979, but you never know. So this could be a very interesting development if those sanctions do go back into place.
As you head at the Heritage Foundation, serving as vice president and head of the Catherine Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy, and the Middle East is one part of your portfolio, but obviously America's place in the world order and the American-China competition is something that you focus on quite a bit as well. What role do you think Israel has in America's counter-China policy, if any?
I think that's a really critical question, because everything we do now at Heritage is through the lens of you know, what is the China angle to it? And there is a China angle to literally everything, from, you know, TikTok and doorbells to nuclear weapons. So, you know, this was something we dealt with in the first Trump term, because Israel's posture when we came in 2017 is that, for example, Chinese investments in Israel were an economic matter that didn't have anything to do with national security. And there were banners up at Ben Gurion welcoming Chinese visitors and so on and so forth. And China thought that was super and came and was trying to invest in a lot of very sensitive tech companies. And that had not been in any way tamped down by the Obama administration. And so, you know, that was something we saw very quickly, and credit to our Israeli counterparts, they started to see it too. And that was one of the most dramatic shifts, is protecting the technological edge that Israel has contributed to so strongly that the United States holds. And at the recent AI summit in Washington, we started talking about a qualitative technological edge to go along with a qualitative military edge. That is something we have to protect as an issue of national security, and that then extends to sensitive infrastructure and those kinds of projects. So I think Israel is, for that reason, invaluable in the competition with China, but also as a sort of point of power projection into the Middle East. Because in the event of war with China, you know, we're not going to be able to be active in Europe, in the Middle East, if we are battling China in the Indo-Pacific. So we need partners and allies like Israel to be that kind of central hub for American partners and allies in the Middle East to coordinate their security if our attention is drawn elsewhere.
So China has definitely proven itself not to be a friend of Israel since October 7th. Barely condemned Hamas, and it took them like a year to give like a tiny little statement, like an aside in a bigger statement. Where do you think Israel is when it comes to China right now? Like its policies, how it's treating China? Do you think it needs to be improved? You know, how do you assess that now?
Well, we can all always get better. We've had a situation last week in Philadelphia, my hometown, where they actually flew the flag of Communist China in front of City Hall as part of Diversity Day and to honor the 80th anniversary of the founding of Communist China. I am not making this up. It happened. I wrote an op-ed on Fox News about it if anybody wishes to get the gory details. It's outrageous. So China's here as well. So I'm not saying we're in any way perfect. We can all get better. But I think where this becomes more compelling for Israel is the growing closeness between Iran and China. that everyone talks about the 2022, you know, partnership without limits between Xi and Putin. Well, there was another agreement, I believe in 2021, between Tehran and Beijing for expanded security and economic cooperation. And they're rapidly becoming members of the same nasty little club. And you can toss North Korea in there too. And because there's a lot of sort of isolation of those countries in the international sphere, they increasingly gang together. And so, you know, that then creates a choice. I mean, if Israel feels Iran is its existential threat, which I would agree with, then Iran's partner, China, is not a good partner to Israel. You know, and it's the same kind of question that eventually will come to India. You know, they historically have been at odds with China, but close to Russia. Given the closeness between Russia and China, is that feasible going forward? I would argue no, and that the better path is closeness with the United States. We obviously have a burden on us to be a good and reliable partner too. But in both those cases, I think the growing kind of Chinese axis of undesirable countries makes it easier for others to figure out what side they're on.
I really like that idea of a qualitative technological edge. And here the Abraham Accords, for example, the partnership with the UAE, US, Israel, and the UAE could play a role in maintaining, say, the Western aligned or the US aligned qualitative technical edge. You bring together the leadership of the United States, the innovation in the of Israel, the capacity and the resources and the experience of the UAE. I think this is a really good opportunity for the countries to work together. I want to ask you one last question. The New York Times, I think, also revealed one of your deep, dark secrets, which is that you have 3 degrees in art history. But I do wonder how your background in art history, how it influenced your role, your thinking, the way you approached these kinds of issues in your national security roles in the White House, in Congress, even now in Heritage.
If I could add to that, I was just saying to Asher before we started this interview that some people were saying that they had those pictures of the sick babies in Gaza, who they then said were starving because of Israel, and they had already had different terrible diseases. All these people were saying that the pictures were structured to look like baby Jesus and Mary. And so I said to Asher, like, maybe we need an art historian to help decipher some of these issues.
Well, I wrote about that. Unfortunately, it's all been archived. But during the 2006 Lebanon War, there was a whole cottage industry of running around and moving bodies around so they would look like a Pietà, or, you know, a Lamentation over the Dead Christ, or a Madonna and Child. They're very good. It's gruesome, but they trigger, you know, these visual memories that people subconsciously have of great works of art, and it gives a kind of a solemnity and almost sanctity to these scenes. So it that is a tried and true terrorist trick. In terms of how it informs my work, I mean, art history is, when responsibly practiced, essentially, you know, history with pictures. And you have, if you want to learn about ancient Athens, you can read Thucydides, and that's a good idea. But you can also look at the Parthenon. And if you do those two things together, you're probably going to have a clearer idea of history. And I think for contemporary policymakers, history is vitally important. If we don't know our history, we're doomed to repeat it. So I have found it very helpful there. One other piece of it is, you know, these are the great works of Western civilization. I'm writing a book right now about the fact that Michelangelo's David and Leonardo's Mona Lisa were created at the same place at the same time, and they're the two most recognizable works of art on the planet. You know, how does that happen? And so that's a really fun project for me, because it really is about defending Western civilization. That it's not to belittle anybody else's civilization, but our civilization produced some rather remarkable things. And not because we were perfect, but because we were able to rise above our many very severe imperfections to, you know, achieve really remarkable things. So that is, I think, important to keep our eye on as we're dealing with the immediate and the urgent and in the day-to-day, that our task here is larger. It is about defending this civilization, you know, this Judeo-Christian moral code, these values that have been fundamental, that all of that is under attack right now. And it's not enough just to like it or say it's a good thing. I think we all need to stand up and defend it. So that's why the art history piece, I actually, in my mind at least, it dovetails with the national security work.
Victoria, it's been such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for coming on to our show. And we look forward to continuing the conversation.
Excellent. Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe so you get the next episode as soon as it happens. And make sure to like and follow Misgav on social media. Our accounts are MisgavINS. And you can follow at www.misgavins.org. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. I hope you enjoy Sukkot, Zman Simchatenu. It's our time of happiness. And we'll see you next week.
Amen, amen. Chag Sameach to everybody celebrating. See you next time.